It's Monday, June 20th, and a new chapter in the vaccination effort begins now. We start here. With authorization from the CDC, vaccines for children as young as 6 months old are being shipped across the country.
The concern is still there, and we want to protect our youngest kids.
But as COVID cases continue to proliferate, how much will that put parents at ease? Apple was created by Steve Jobs. Now could it be sustained by union jobs?
There is a dam that seems to have broken now.
The organization drive that has electrified the rest of the tech world. And is it more helpful for self-defense or for the attacker?
How many rounds am I holding right here?
Probably about 200 rounds.
As gun regulations threaten to hit a wall, we'll take you inside the emerging market for body armor. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. From the moment COVID-19 was declared a pandemic, it took about 8 months for the U.S. to authorize a vaccine for it. Incredibly fast when you think about it. But for the next year and a half, millions of American parents have said, I still can't get the most vulnerable member of my family vaccinated.
I honestly couldn't be more excited that there's a vaccine on the way. I think, you know, like a lot of parents, we've lived for the past 2 years with a lot of fear.
Well, just in the last few days, the FDA has authorized vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna for children as young as 6 months old. A CDC panel agreed with them on Saturday, and then in the last 48 hours, the CDC director herself has signed off.
We now know, based on rigorous scientific review, that the vaccines available here in the United States can be used safely and effectively in children under five.
And with these new smaller doses being shipped across the country, shots for children under five could start going into arms as soon as today. National holiday today means it'll probably be tomorrow for a lot of people, but the bottom line is, you now live in a country where basically anyone is allowed to get a vaccine. But is this the turning point that families have been hoping for? We're joined by someone who's been watching this whole pandemic through the eyes of children and families. John Brownstein is with Boston Children's Hospital, along with Harvard Medical School. He's also an ABC News contributor. And John, a million Americans have died from COVID-19. I'm looking at the CDC data. 500,000 of those were over 75 years old. Another 250,000 of them were between 65 and 75. The number of kids under four that have died from COVID is 442. And yet when I hear from parents, they see this as a sea change moment. Why?
Well, remember, Brad, I mean, these are our youngest kids. They should not be dying of any infectious disease at this point.
Vaccinating young children is a critical opportunity to protect them against hospitalization and death from COVID-19.
The second thing is, it's not just about mortality. It's about infection. It's about hospitalization, right? The thousands of kids that have ended up in the hospital because of infection. And then we have to talk about long COVID.
We're seeing case reports all over the place from 5, 10, maybe more percent of these kids who are being diagnosed with long COVID.
These are symptoms that persist for months, and we still don't fully understand the cognitive impacts, the physical impacts of long-term infection. So yes, you know, the numbers are different when you go into older age groups, but the concern is still there, and we want to protect our youngest kids. This is finally a moment we can do so for those 6 months and over, that is.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you said about long COVID, because like we don't know what COVID 5 years on looks like, and these are the kids who would be dealing with it. Is that one of the most common questions you're getting from parents? What are the most common questions you're getting from families right now, and how do you answer them?
Right now, it's all about the vaccine gauntlet. Just like in adults, everyone's trying to time their second booster to what might happen in the future with reformulations. This question about which vaccine timing, or if you have a kid at 4 years old, about to turn five, what do you do? I've been saying basically the same thing regardless of age, which is you have a recommendation, you're this particular age group, get, you know, whatever's recommended for you right now, and whichever vaccine happens to be at your pediatrician's office or the pharmacy, that's the one you should get.
Both vaccines are safe, the Pfizer and the Moderna. We know that they both produce a very good, strong immunological response, which is really important.
Try to just get whichever one happens to be available to you at the time.
Hey, more broadly, where does this moment where essentially the entire population can get vaccinated starting today, where does this fit in the broader context of COVID? Because right now, you look at the numbers, we're seeing more than 100,000 positive COVID cases every day, right? Is this the way things are going to be for the rest of 2022? Just that, because we're not that many policies are changing right now.
Right. You know, I think as I just cough, dealing with my long COVID cough right now, you know, I just went through 20 days of infection. And so, you know, it's hard to...
Wait, that's a real thing you're saying? That like, that's a real effect you've had?
Well, I talking about COVID for the last 2.5 years, in fact, it finally got me for the first time, you know, got reasonably sick, did Paxlovid, got a rebound, now have a persistent cough. You know, it tells me that we're not necessarily in a sort of steady state with this pandemic quite yet. So from my perspective, I think the jury is still out. We have a new variant likely to emerge in the fall, but we'll have new vaccines, a bivalent vaccine that probably is more targeted to what we're experiencing. At the same time, you know, people are enduring some significant impacts of this virus, and it's not something you necessarily just want to let rip. So, you know, I'm still, you know, not convinced we're quite at the steady state yet. We're in a much better place with vaccines and therapeutics. But I'm, you know, I'm not anywhere near declaring victory on this pandemic and ready to fully move forward.
Well, and that makes me wonder, Dr. Brownstein, like, if families get the final member of that family vaccinated, psychologically, does that make that family also go, well, now we're good to go? Like, let's start sending them to the sleepovers, send them to summer camp. We were scared. Now we're not. But then you are also creating more situations where the kids are spreading even more COVID amongst each other, and we're perpetuating this cycle that we are seeing among the rest of the population. Like, is that what happens to us just naturally?
It's a very interesting question, Brad, because for so many families that I know in our community, they've been holding out for this vaccine. This was the last step, getting those younger kids protected. And then finally, they can emerge and you know, travel, vacation, you know, go into large gatherings. It'll be interesting to see if you know, this was the moment that will change. I do think, given, as you mentioned, you know, 100,000 cases a day, you know, these are still very large numbers. We're, you know, hopefully on the other side of a BA2 surge, at least in this region. Other regions are going to be dealing with it. I think different families are going to approach this, you know, differently. Some will just be like, okay, now we can live. And others can be like, you know, I still recognize that, you know, COVID is a threat even on top of, you know, vaccine. The vaccine protects me, but I'm still concerned about the long-term impacts of this virus. So I do hope that people can turn a page and start to live more normally, but still have that sort of healthy concern about, you know, avoiding infection as much as possible. And that might be mean masking where we're needed to.
Right. If you're concerned about serious immediate illness, that risk is alleviated. But as John Brownstein said, we still don't know exactly how this plays out in kids or adults. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, they want a bigger bite of the apple, and they just might get it. The union effort that thinks different, after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
A while back, we talked about how workers at one Starbucks location finally overcame the odds and voted to unionize for the very first time in company history. Instead of trying to organize every worker at every Starbucks, this group focused on just doing this one. Since that moment, dozens of Starbucks cafes have followed suit. And if you think that would be a big deal for Starbucks, you're right. But what about the most valuable company in the world? Well, this weekend, a group of employees at an Apple store voted to form the first union in that company's history.
It felt like the world was kind of just lifted. You know, all these efforts like came to, you know, real life. Like this is some real stuff.
Which it's not just a big deal for those workers, but perhaps for people all throughout the entire tech space. Josh Idelson is a reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, where he covers labor specifically. And Josh, this was an Apple store in Maryland, right? What can you tell us about it?
So about 100 workers voted in an election around 2-1 to join the Machinists Union. This is the first time that there has been a successful unionization election at any Apple store in the United States, and it comes amid a wave of efforts by multiple unions in multiple states to organize Apple stores, and a larger wave of organizing at many of the most prominent non-union companies in the United States.
Not just Amazon workers, but as you mentioned, all workers all across the nation, any industry right now, the labor movement is booming right now. We're happy to be a part of that.
And a victory like this, as we've seen at Starbucks, can be totally electrifying for workers elsewhere who are on the fence. I've talked to a lot of Starbucks workers this year who've said once they saw workers in Buffalo, New York win their union, that was when it felt worthwhile to take the plunge themselves.
What are the complaints among these Apple employees? Like, whenever I go to an Apple store, like anywhere in the country, the employees are extremely cheerful, like very, very cheerful. So what is the back and forth with the company here?
Well, seeming bizarrely cheerful can be a lot of work in and of itself, the emotional labor in that customer service interaction. Apple workers have talked about the pay and the tremendous wealth that they are creating for the company each day.
You know, Apple's a $3.1 trillion company, the biggest company in the world. But starting pay is, at least in my market, is $20 an hour. That doesn't match the cost of living up here.
Just if you look at the money brought in per square foot of those stores, some people have compared it to a diamond store.
Wow.
And there is a contrast between the wealth that these workers are bringing in on a daily basis and the pay that they're getting in exchange for it. The pandemic has also been a radicalizing experience for workers in all sorts of industries who came out of it saying they wanted more of a say in their working conditions, including their safety. And that's something that's been brought up at the Apple stores as well.
It's interesting, Josh, that like there seems to be this larger organizing trend of people forming unions store by store, warehouse by warehouse. You mentioned that, which seems super significant in this country. I've also found interesting in your reporting about how Apple is not just some other retail store, right? It is a tech giant, and labor unions are becoming more popular among tech workers specifically. Why is that?
The flagship tech companies that we think of when we think of the tech industry in the United States have been resiliently non-union for many years. And
the Apples, the Googles, the Amazons.
That's right. And there is a dam that seems to have broken now with an Amazon warehouse unionizing smaller victories like subcontracted workers for Google Fiber, who unionized with the communications workers recently. And now this Apple Store union, which is certain to have an impact on organizing efforts elsewhere.
And kind of the idea, I guess, for us isn't just for our store, but is to, you know, stand behind every other store that might be feeling the way that we feel. You know, the thought is that everybody else could be inspired.
Some of these tech companies that prided themselves in the past on an atmosphere of questioning authority, they would say, of freewheeling debate, faced in recent years, not just with unionization efforts, but with collective action and collective dissent by workers, and very much not welcoming it.
We have a relationship that's based on an open and collaborative and direct engagement, which I feel could fundamentally change if a store is represented by a union under a collective bargaining agreement.
Apple, in its messages to the media, has been terse and emphasized its benefits, but we have reported at Bloomberg messages that the company management has shared with employees in which they make the case against organizing.
And I worry about what it would mean to put another organization in the middle of our relationship, an organization that does not have a deep understanding of Apple or our business, and most importantly, one that I do not believe shares our commitment to you.
There have been allegations from workers and union organizers that the company has been coercive in its efforts to resist organizing, including by interrogating workers, by restricting the distribution of leaflets, and by holding mandatory so-called captive audience meetings in which workers are required to listen to messages about why they shouldn't unionize.
Yeah, and that sound you heard there was actually of an Apple retail executive giving employees essentially reasons not to unionize last month. This video is widely circulated by workers. Apple has still not commented on those claims of making employees watch it. Josh Idelson from Bloomberg, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Last week was supposed to be the deadline for negotiations on a new package of gun laws in the U.S. Senate. But within that group of 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats, well, they're still talking.
We'll try to resolve it because I think everybody would like to have a result.
Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, said there are still concerns over things like red flag laws and the so-called boyfriend loophole. At what point, conservatives say, should someone not be considered safe enough to own a gun?
There's current relationships that are covered by the law, and the Democrats want to define other relationships, and it's a little bit vague.
And as last week came to a close, Cornyn expressed frustration that common ground was becoming difficult to find, signaling he was playing hardball. But this weekend in Texas, the state's Republican Party officially rebuked Cornyn for even being a part of these talks, for even considering some of these new laws.
Senior United States Senator John Cornyn.
Which makes you wonder, what if nothing happens in these talks? What if, at the end of the day, the same people have the same access to guns in this country? And what some experts have pointed out is, it's not just the guns.
Police say the 18-year-old gunman crashed a car outside Robb Elementary School, then ran inside with an AR-15-style rifle and body armor.
Increasingly, we have seen shooters use not just weapons, but tactical gear designed to keep them from being immobilized. And so recently, ABC's Mary Alice Parks looked into the growing market for body armor. She joins us now. Mary Alice, what kind of equipment are we talking about here?
Yeah, it was interesting. The Buffalo Police Commissioner testified on Capitol Hill before lawmakers that the shooter up there came ready for a fight. He came wearing tactical body armor
and a tactical helmet on. He was shot at least one time that we had uncovered through our evidence, and that had no effect on him.
And retired police officer Aaron Salter Jr. actually was able to hit him, but couldn't stop him in part because of the gear he was wearing. And you know, Officer Salter lost his life. And that is what is so interesting right now. We've heard from more and more experts that there is this growing market of this sort of military grade, heavy duty tactical body armor that's being sold online. You can go on Amazon right now. You can order a lot of it quickly. It can arrive at your house in days.
You said you use this as a training vest.
Yes, I use this. I'm in the Army Reserves, and this is what I wear when I go to drill.
I talked to Keith Barrett, who's one of the largest retailers of tactical body armor and all kinds of body armor on the East Coast. We met him at a gun show outside Philadelphia, and he really walked us through just the range of stuff he sells.
But certified armor, certified by the National Institute of Justice, which falls under Department of Justice, is usually going to start in the $600 range on a really low end.
Okay.
The average police vest costs about $1,000 to $1,500.
Wow.
You know, some stuff that he said is more designed to take, you know, one or two handgun shots or even like a knife stabbing that's really light. And he says he sells those and markets those to like a bouncer at a nightclub in a downtown.
So this is a full kit that includes everything.
I mean, I can barely carry it.
And then he sells military grade stuff. You know, I put on this one vest and, I mean, first of all, it was camouflage, but it was also had pockets for several magazines, rounds of ammo.
Okay, so this has, how many rounds am I holding right here?
Probably about 200 rounds.
Huge plating that covers all around, so there's no gaps. And it's, you know, really designed for the most extreme level of protection, designed to be able to take, you know, repeated rifle rounds.
And you're probably wearing about 40 pounds at this point.
Well, so if you're somebody who walks into a gun show or into a gun dealer and you get your AR-15 along with body armor, are there restrictions on the body armor or how much you're allowed to, like, make yourself impenetrable?
In practice, the short answer is no. There's technically a law in the books that says if you're a felon convicted of a violence-related crime, you can't buy this stuff. But in reality, there's no law requiring the seller to do a background check. And so even those the guys we talked to at the gun show said that they don't do background checks. That's not they're not required to do it. So they're taking people at their word. And that's, you know, only at the federal level. At the state level, the state of Connecticut says you can't buy it online. The city of Chicago technically bans it.
Thoughts and prayers won't fix this. But taking strong action will.
The state of New York, actually, after the Buffalo shooting, did pass a new law, though a lot of experts are saying that that was kind of written too quickly and narrowly and probably in the end won't include the kind of newest, most heavy-duty stuff like the Buffalo shooter used. So there's kind of this patchwork, very little patchwork regulation.
But it's also a point of emulation behavior. Shooters looking to previous attackers for inspiration and wanting to be like them.
So I spoke to one author, Mark Fulman, who has been studying mass shootings and mass shooters and their profiles for decades. He wrote a book, The Trigger Points, and he's wondering whether if someone happens to buy ammo and a rifle and tactical body armor in a week, would there be a way that you could use that to ping law enforcement?
There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about a right to tactical gear.
It's hard to know if that kind of thing would be practical, but it's something experts are talking about because it's starting to seem like more and more of a trend.
But on the other side of that, Mary Alice, like, if we're not going to stop people from arming themselves, is this really the thing? Like, are we really going to stop people from buying stuff that would stop all these bullets? Forget the mass shooters. I'm talking about like regular people who are nervous about the amount of gunfire in the world right now.
Yeah, that's the debate.
The whole purpose of it is that we have a product for everyone. So we have armor for kids. We have armor for morbidly obese people.
At this gun show, guys that were selling this said, you know, who are we to say that you can't own a piece of protective equipment? I heard it described to me as just the same as a windshield or a seatbelt or eye protection at a shooting range.
Have you actually sold something like that to a mom that said, I'm putting this in my kid's backpack?
Yeah, actually often. People are concerned about the operational and security environment at school or public places in general.
My conversations with law enforcement members were so different. They are so skeptical about why civilians would need to wear tactical body armor. But on the other hand, when you walk through the gun shows and you look at some of these websites and look at the advertising and talk to some of the experts that are looking at just how this trend is growing, there's also clearly marketing with this message about being combat ready, being ready for anything, ready to take on whoever's coming. And that seems to be sort of a growing subculture among gun enthusiasts.
All right, really great reporting. Mary Alice Parks, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we return, before Wuhan, there was another epicenter of a pandemic. It just took us 700 years to find. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. COVID-19 has only been around a few years, and we still have a lot to learn, but the same can still be said for another pandemic that happened much, much longer ago.
I am death. Vengeance is mine.
The bubonic plague killed millions of people in the 1300s, its effects lingered for half a millennium, and its origins have long baffled scientists. Until now.
The origins of the Black Death has been one of the most hotly debated controversies in the history of plague and perhaps in the history in general.
In the journal Nature, scientists claimed they were able to analyze DNA markers in the bodies of people buried under headstones from 1338. These were people who had apparently died from what was then called pestilence.
So it's about 25% of 467 burials are dated to those 2 years. So I thought, wow, I mean, that sounds really intriguing.
So they examined the pulp of these victims' teeth and found this DNA that apparently still resembles what came to be known as the Black Death.
It's especially interesting because some scholars had thought that the plague had come from, guess where, China. Well, according to this analysis, it looks like it spread from this village in what is now known as Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. From there, it went along trading routes, infecting scores of people around the world. And just like COVID, a big question has always been, how did this virus actually spread to humans? I mean, for a disease that wiped out half of Europe's population at the time, you'd think we'd know by now. And while fleas on rats are the story, they certainly helped it, the scientists also discovered a strain of this viral DNA is residing in this region of Kyrgyzstan to this day in local marmots. The little animals that look like gophers. And after hundreds of marmot generations, these human scientists might have finally gotten some answers out of them. Okay, that talking gene strand in Jurassic Park who was explaining everything, he did not tell me DNA could be found in my teeth. But nice to know we will eventually have some answers here, hopefully less than 700 years. If you're digging the show, please hit us up with a 5-star rating and review. Tell a friend about the show. Tell a marmot friend about the show. Let them know, you guys are in the news. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.